Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, as President Obama underlined this week, we are getting out of Iraq. You know, not totally. Not all of us. Not all of our guys and gals. But, you know, enough so that we don't have to talk about it in the upcoming election campaign. So let's take this moment, let's take this period of time to look back with some pride, I think, with some busting buttons at exactly what we've left behind. As the American mission ends, it's more than 7 years since the state of electricity started being one of the most closely watched benchmarks of our effort to transform Iraq. Iraq's government now still struggles to provide electricity and other basic services. Baghdad, the capital, had 5 hours of electricity a day this past July. You do know in Baghdad, it gets to be, in the hundreds, 110s, 120s during the summertime. The chronic power shortages are the result of myriad factors, including war, drought, and corruption, but ultimately they reflect a dysfunctional government that remains deadlocked and unresponsive to popular will. Okay, don't thank us. This is from the Post-Gazette, I believe in Pittsburgh. That has generated disillusionment and dissent, including protests this summer. Democracy didn't bring us anything, said a shopkeeper. Then he corrected himself. Democracy bought us a can of Coke and a beer. What do you want, Diet Coke? Iraqis' expectations of a reliable supply of electricity and other services have exceeded what either Americans or their country's quarreling politicians have so far been able to meet. The electricity problem is older than this new form of government. Before the Hussein invasion of Kuwait 20 years ago, Iraq had the capacity to produce 9,200 megawatts of power. By 2003, after American bombings, it was half that. The shortages have hobbled economic development and disrupted every aspect of daily life. I've never seen good electricity from the day I was born, said a 22-year-old barber in Sadr City, or a Sadr in Barber City. The United States has spent $5 billion on electrical projects, nearly 10% of the $53 billion it's devoted to rebuilding Iraq, second only to spending on security. There's been inefficiency and corruption, as in projects to rebuild schools, water, and sewage systems. The Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction said one quarter of 54 reconstruction projects his office has investigated, including those providing electricity, had not been completed or carried on by the Iraqis they were built for. 25% might as well have never been built at all. But the good news is we spent the money. And Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki's chances of keeping his job suffered a setback this week when a coalition of Shiite, can I say that on the radio, parties that appeared to represent his best hope of staying in office, broke off talks with his slate. U.S. officials have watched the stalemate with growing consternation as they prepare for the pullout. The United States is about to send a new ambassador and a new commanding general to Baghdad. American officials hoped to start the pullout after the Iraqi government was seated. But now the White House will dispatch a team to Baghdad to assist with the transition. And a few American experts on Iraqi politics who played key roles during the surge are temporarily returning to Baghdad to advise U.S. officials on the mess. American officials are wondering how Maliki will respond to the new stalemate. He can do unexpected things that are not even in his best interest when he's cornered, said an American official who advises the Iraqi government. Doesn't that remind you what they used to say about Saddam Hussein? It does me. Now news of food. Food dyes used in everything from M&M's to Manischewitz matzo balls to Kraft salad dressings pose risks of cancer, hyperactivity in children, and allergies, and should be banned, according to a new report by the Center for Science and the Public Interest. A top government scientist agrees, saying that food dyes present unnecessary risks to the public. The three most widely used dyes, red 40, yellow 5, and yellow 6, are contaminated with known carcinogens, according to the Center for Science and the Public Interest. Another dye, red 3, has been acknowledged for years by the FDA to be a carcinogen, and it's still in the food supply. Each year, manufacturers pour about 15 million pounds of 8 synthetic dyes into our foods. Well, Who wants to eat food that doesn't look good? What? Per capita consumption of dyes has increased fivefold since the 1950s, thanks to the proliferation of brightly colored breakfast cereals, fruit drinks, and candies. These synthetic chemicals do absolutely nothing to improve the nutritional quality or safety of foods, but trigger behavior problems in children and possibly cancer in anybody, says the executive director of the center. Blue 1, Red 40, Yellow 5, and Yellow 6. Hey, you know, if you guys spent a little more time on their names, we wouldn't be having this problem. Have long been known to cause allergic reactions in some people. While those reactions are not common, they can be serious and provide reason enough to ban those dyes, says the center. Further, numerous studies have demonstrated that dyes cause hyperactivity in children. Go figure. And pancreatic tumor cells use fructose to divide and proliferate, U.S. researchers now say. In a study that challenges the common wisdom that all sugars are the same, tumor cells fed both glucose and fructose use the two sugars in two different ways, says the team from UCLA. Go Bruins! They said their finding may help to explain other studies that link fructose intake with pancreatic cancer. They have major significance for cancer patients given dietary refined fructose consumption, says the leader of the study. Yes, high fructose corn syrup is, in fact, high in fructose. Hello, welcome to the show.
Charlie, you're not my Charlie anymore. You're screwing it up. You're killing your soul with an audience looking on. If I hadn't left early last night, I would have made a speech to you. You're not the only one you're going to hurt. If you don't believe me, I don't believe in you. If you don't believe me, I don't believe in you. Makes it all feel better. Makes you feel like heaven, does it? You loved it and you spent accordingly. You can't afford it now. You can't afford it now. You can't afford it now. You try and you fail. And love it like a little dog. And feed it on the scraps you find. And kiss it while you're still asleep. You buy now and pay later. So where's the problem, you can ask, if you keep your head up? But the road is long and you're falling asleep at the wheel. Is a girl going crazy about you and I'm not far behind? Can you care about your friends anymore? If you don't believe me, I don't believe in you. If you don't believe me, I don't believe in you. Makes it all feel better. Does it? And makes you feel like heaven, does it? Loved it and you spent accordingly. You can't afford it now. You can't afford it now. You can't afford it now. You try and you fail. And love it like a little dog. And feed it on the scraps you find. And kiss it while you're still asleep. You buy now and pay later. You buy now and pay later. Is a girl going crazy about you, and I'm not far behind.
From beautiful West London, England, overlooking more of West London, England, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. Don't fight it. You fight it, you lose. From Marketing Daily, the daily thing about marketing, comes this. Freescore.com's campaign features Score Guys. It's not what you think. I'll read it for you. Freescore.com is introducing a new ad campaign featuring the three Score Guys, joining previous ad efforts featuring actor, economist, lawyer Ben Stein. The new campaign is in direct response to a May 2010 awareness survey of 1,000 U.S. consumers, 57% of whom did not realize they have three major credit scores. The new campaign highlights the Norwalk, Connecticut-based company's main offering, providing consumers with immediate access to all three scores. The online site provides unlimited access to all three scores and a complete credit profile for a fee. The Ben Stein campaign established the freescore.com as a credit score site and will continue to run. Since the company's launch in July 2009, over 750,000 people have signed up to pay for Freescore. The new TV spot includes three Score Guys wearing black leotard-type suits supporting a credit score, appearing as a consumer obtains a car loan. The commercial points out that one bad score can potentially ruin anyone's ability to obtain a loan. Campaigns intended to remind people that checking one credit score is not enough. Marketing executive for the company compares the use of the two creative approaches, Ben Stein and the Score Guys, to Geico having both the Gecko and Caveman creative executions. Quote, Ben Stein reinforces our service quality. Unquote. That's Phil Sandler, Vice President of Marketing at Freescore.com, who believes that. And it's Marketing Daily, which runs this whole story without a note of irony about the fact that you pay a fee to get the service offered by Freescore.com. Unacknowledged irony. A rare occurrence when I read the trades for you. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's clean, it's safe, it's cheap, it's too everything to meter. Activists are questioning the thoroughness of the cleanup at an old nuclear weapons plant northwest of Denver. Of course, that's what activists do. That's why they're activists. I'm a pacifist. Not a pacifist, although I probably am one of those, but I'm a pacifist. So if you ever see me described as an activist, you know to call the copy desk immediately. Anyway, they say they found particles of weapons-grade plutonium. That's the good plutonium, weapons-grade. That's the best. In air samples taken near the old nuclear weapons plant site. Just so happens, don't you know, that part of the site is a national wildlife refuge slated to open for public recreation. Stay for the animals. No, come for the animals. Stay for the plutonium. The Federal Department of Energy declared in 2005 that its decontamination of Rocky Flats was complete after a 10-year effort that cost $7 billion. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is planning to allow public recreation at the refuge established in 2007 on part of the Rocky Flats site. The interesting thing is that we found no plutonium in two samples and a lot of plutonium in two other samples. Yeah, that is interesting. That's Mark Kaltofen, the head of a Boston lab that identified the particles. They were collected in April by the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center, which has criticized the quality of the cleanup. Plutonium particles were present in dust from a crawl space in an older home near the plant. Don't go in there, you kids. Kaltofen said the highly toxic substance presumably accumulated during the period from 52 to 94 when workers assembled the plutonium pits used as triggers for hydrogen bombs. Me, I use prune pits or plum pits, but that's why my bombs don't work. Kaltofen also said he found traces of less than 0.5% of plutonium and americium. Pledge allegiance to that element, won't you? Which he called significant, a huge amount. It would be a good project to check all these older homes, he said. The microscopic plutonium particles can be easily inhaled, ingested, or absorbed through an open wound. If plutonium is lodged in the body, it bombards the surrounding tissue with radiation, which increases the risk of cancer and genetic defects. This small sampling project indicates that Rocky Flats is a local hazard forever, said the activist. Officials at the Colorado Wildlife Service and the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment didn't respond to phone calls and emails seeking comment. They have previously maintained that plutonium does not reach hazardous levels at Rocky Flats. Thomas Cochran, a nuclear expert at the National Resources Defense Council, said the latest data are probably not sufficient to cause an alarm, but added, you'd want to investigate further. In 2006, a jury awarded nearly $500 million in a verdict against the government contractors that operated Rocky Flats in a class action suit brought on behalf of 12,000 homeowners who claimed that plutonium had been released off-site, thereby damaging their property values. See, the market will take care of everything, ladies and gentlemen. You release plutonium, I'll sue you for hurting my housing price. And as Germany's wild boar population has skyrocketed in recent years, did you know? Me neither. I thought it was pretty stable, the wild boar population in Germany. That was my mistake. But so too has risen the number of animals contaminated by radioactivity left over from Chernobyl, this according to Der Spiegel. Government payments compensating hunters for lost income due to radioactive boar have quadrupled since 2007. Take heed, BP. Germany does have a wild boar problem. Stories of marauding pigs hit the headlines with startling regularity. 10 days ago, a wild boar attacked a wheelchair-bound man in a park in Berlin. In early July, a pack of almost 24 repeatedly marched into the eastern German town of Eisenach, frightening residents and the horses and keeping police busy. Even worse, though, almost a quarter of a century after the Chernobyl nuclear meltdown in Ukraine, a good chunk of Germany's wild boar population remains slightly radioactive, and the phenomenon has been costing the German government an increasing amount of money in recent years. The reasoning for the climbing payments has to do with Germany's skyrocketing wild boar population, not with an increase in contamination. In the last couple of years, wild boar have rapidly multiplied. An Environment Ministry spokesman said, not only is there more corn being farmed, but warmer winters have contributed to a boar boom. That's got to be a loud boom. Many of the boar that are killed land on the plates of diners across Germany, but it's forbidden to sell meat containing high levels of radioactive cesium-137. Any animal showing contamination levels higher than 600 becquerel per kilogram, really, must be disposed of. In some areas of Germany, particularly in the south, wild boar routinely show much higher levels of contamination. Germany's atomic energy law mandates that the government in Berlin pay compensation to hunters who harvest contaminated animals. Wild boar are particularly susceptible to radioactive contamination due to their predilection for chomping on mushrooms and truffles, which are particularly efficient at absorbing radioactivity. Whereas radioactivity in some vegetation is expected to continue declining, the contamination of some kinds of mushroom and truffles will remain the same and may even rise slightly, even a quarter century after the Chernobyl accident. It's clean. It's safe. It's delicious. It's nuclear power. And now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector
Author of the Rolling Stone article that ended the military career of General Stanley McChrystal, the former top commander in Afghanistan, has been denied permission to join U.S. troops fighting in Afghanistan, according to the Pentagon. The rejection came as the Pentagon ramped up an internal investigation into the circumstances behind some of the most salacious material that writer Michael Hastings used in his Rolling Stone article. The Army Inspector General is interviewing current and former aides of McChrystal. The Inspector General's review began shortly after Rolling Stone published the article that torpedoed McChrystal's three-decade Army career. The Inspector General is considering whether officers were insubordinate and how far up the chain of command responsibility for decisions involving the interviews extended. We'll be watching for that. Meanwhile, the U.S. Defense Department is unable to account for almost $9 billion taken from Iraqi oil reserves for use in reconstruction, according to the U.S. Special Investigator for Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction. So we don't know where $9 billion went, but we're going to know why McChrystal mouthed off to Rolling Stone. You see? Get it? The report says $8.7 billion out of $9 billion withdrawn between 2004 and 2007 from a special account set up by the U.N. Security Council is unaccounted for. This is separate from $53 billion set aside by Congress. Though the special investigator found that some of the money was spent properly, Iraqis continually complained that they have seen little sign of their infrastructure being rebuilt, as we know about the electricity. The scale of the sums unaccounted for are particularly striking, given they cover periods well after serious fraud and corruption had been widely publicized in Iraq and abroad. The audit says no organization in the Defense Department was set up to oversee how money from the Development Fund for Iraq was spent, adding that the breakdown in controls left the funds vulnerable to inappropriate uses and undetected loss. Many of the organizations at the Pentagon that received funds failed to establish the accounts required to track the funds. The report cited poor record-keeping and said most of the organizations at the Pentagon that received these funds failed to use required Treasury Department accounts. The military failed to produce any records whatsoever for $2 billion of the money. But they're going to know why that guy talked to Rolling Stone. Dateline Washington FBI Director Robert Mueller told Congress this week he does not know how many of the agents... He does not know how many agents cheated on an important test about the limitations of the Bureau's powers to conduct surveillance in open cases without evidence. The Justice Department Inspector General is investigating whether hundreds of FBI agents cheated on the test, a possible scandal that could be further embarrassment for the FBI as it continues cleaning up after years of collecting phone records without court approval. FBI men cheating. You know who's rolling over in his grave, and you know who he's rolling over on. Ladies and gentlemen, drug and illegal alien smuggling, bribes, kickbacks, possession of child pornography, attempted child sex abuse. These are just some of the crimes Department of Homeland Security employees and contractors were convicted of last year, according to a report from the department's Office of Inspector General. The Inspector General's office describes the report's release as a reminder to DHS employees not to betray the public's trust. That's always good advice, isn't it? The 24-page report lists only a few of the crimes reported by each agency covered by the Inspector General. Mainly the anecdotal summaries of convictions describe general corruption, particularly at the border. So rest easy, ladies and gentlemen. Just some crimes at Homeland Security. News of the Inspectors General, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. More of Le Show after this important message.
The economy is tanking. The dollar is drowning. Stocks don't make me laugh. And by the way, I never laugh. I'm G. Gordon Liddy. And if you're as scared about the future as I am trying to make you, you know you can't trust your security to stocks or insurance or even precious metal. You have basic needs. And sure, you've probably already got a good stock of food and water. But what about air? Without it, breathing is virtually impossible. Yet, if you're like most people, you've probably assumed it would always be there. That's how I thought until 10 years ago, when I met the people at Crossland Oxygen, America's leading suppliers of fine investment-grade breathable air for home and family. Maybe you think you can't afford to keep a well-maintained 2-month supply of pure, breathable air at or near your home. But think about this. You can't afford not to. Crossland Oxygen obtains the finest oxygen and nitrogen on the market, blends them according to their own proprietary formula for maximum blood support, and then seals it in titanium tanks that make a great addition to any den or basement. Sure, other companies are rushing into the emergency breathable air business, but you can trust Crossland. After all, that's where I buy my breathable air. Don't leave your respiration to chance. That's the sound of breathing, no matter what happens. That's the sound of Crossland Oxygen.
This is London, and this is Le Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Song. to the warmth.
Yes, we can. Polar bears in the Hudson Bay area of Canada are likely to die out in the next 3 decades, possibly sooner, as global warming melts more Arctic ice and thus reduces their hunting opportunities. This according to Canadian biologists. Yes, they have Canadian biologists. Think of it. The animals in western Hudson Bay, one of 19 discrete subpopulations of polar bears around the Arctic, are losing fat and body mass as their time on the floating sea ice gets shorter and shorter, according to the researchers from the University of Alberta. It's the polar bear diet. Everybody's doing it. The sea ice is where the bears hunt. Ringed and bearded seals, their favorite prey. Aww. And they have to build up strength fast. They have to build up enough fat in the winter when the ice is at its greatest to get through the summer when the ice retreats from the shoreline and the bears find no food. But the ice has been melting earlier in the spring and forming later in the autumn, so the bears are now spending on average 3 more weeks on land per year without food than they did 3 decades ago. As a consequence, their body weight in that time has dropped by 60 pounds. Females have lost 10% of their body length. And you don't want a short female polar bear if you're a male. Trust me. And the West Hudson Bay population has declined from 1,200 animals to 900. If the decline in sea ice continues, as predictions indicate it will, it's feared the bears could die out in 25 to 30 years, perhaps as few as 10, if there's a succession of years with very low sea ice cover. The Hudson Bay group of bears is the second most southerly population and might be expected to feel the effects of climate change early. The Arctic sea ice as a whole reached its lowest ever recorded extent in September 3 years ago. In the last 2 years, it's recovered, but it's once again declining rapidly this year. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it's a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. The polar bear diet, check into it, look into it. It's going to be in all the magazines. News of Atac! In the Panjwai district to the west of Kandahar in Afghanistan, U.S. officials say the district governor and the police chief recently got into a fight. The chief hit the governor with a tea kettle, don't you know, and the governor smashed a teacup on the chief's head. The confrontation quickly escalated from tea accessories to a shootout between their guards. From tea to guns in Afghanistan, from the Washington Post, this story. In Aurangabad, U.S. military and civilian officials spent a year working with and praising the district governor, Abdul Jabbar. Oh, man, the skyhook. Oh, no, different. When he was killed in a bar bombing in Kandahar this summer, the officials blamed the Taliban. But some of those same officials concluded the governor was skimming U.S. funds for reconstruction projects in his district. His killing, they think, was the result of anger by fellow residents over his not distributing the spoils, not a Taliban assassination. It was a mob hit, said one U.S. official familiar with the situation. We saw him as a white knight, but we were getting played the whole time. Because that's how much we know about where we're playing around these days. On a related topic, news from outside the bubble. The U.S. State Department has released its annual report into terrorist threats. I'm sure this has been all over the American media, but this is from the London newspaper, The Telegraph. State Department says, despite suffering the loss of a significant number of senior figures, Al-Qaeda's leadership in Pakistan's tribal areas remained the most formidable terrorist threat to the United States. More drones! The report said the terror group remained adaptable and resilient and continued to plot attacks against America while building affiliates in Yemen and Africa. Let's go fight there! The organization has retained its ability to attract and train new recruits, including some from Europe and North America, such as the Nigerian student behind the attempted Christmas Day bombing. The State Department's analysis underlines how nearly 9 years after 9/11, Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri remain in command of al-Qaeda, able to communicate with increasingly well-organized affiliates elsewhere. According to the report, the increased use of remote-controlled drones hasn't prevented al-Qaeda from readily training and funding the Taliban-led insurgency in Afghanistan. in that country. Despite some heavy losses among militants and their leaders, the Taliban's ability to recruit foot soldiers from its core base of rural Pashtuns remains undiminished. Not reduced, not impacted, undiminished, unquote, our very own State Department. Yes, it's been all the news in the States, I'm sure, but it's news from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Cast a spell on you, and you don't know what to do.
Ladies and gentlemen, in news of public radio, National Public Radio has changed its name to NPR. Much like the corporate names KFC or AT&T, the initials now stand for the initials. NPR says it's abbreviating the name because it's more than radio these days. It operates news and music websites. NPR is more modern, streamlined, says Vivian Schiller, NPR's chief executive. She points to other rebrandings by media organizations such as Cable News Network, which has been CNN for years. NPR hasn't formally announced the change, but it has told its staff and affiliated stations to use only the initials on the air or online. But NPR's affiliates, which contribute about 40% of the operating budget, are still primarily in the radio business. Some station managers have grumbled NPR has invested in digital operations at the expense of more and better radio programs. How could there be better radio programs? PBS, NPR's public TV counterpart, still officially refers to itself as the Public Broadcasting Service. But that's not all.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is Below the Beltway. Below the Beltway. Behind the scenes of the scenes in our nation's capital. I'm Milton Getzler. And this week we're pulling open the curtain on the behind-the-scenes activity right here at CPR. After another public radio network jettisoned its name and retained only its initials, officials here at CPR launched a network-wide brainstorming session, or as it's called inside these walls, a think stock. Here's CPR's special correspondent, Aviva Schlorman, who followed all the inaction from close range.
The question was simple. Should CPR retain its full name, Continental Public Radio, or just be known from now on by its initials? The network's think stock brought in experts on everything from marketing to communications. CPR's vice president for marketing, development, and parking resources, Harlow Marlow, argued in favor of...
Over the past quarter century, we've succeeded in making the letter CPR the seventh best-known brand at all of public radio. Now, in a new digital age, people don't have time for legacy names. It's been a long time since CBS called itself the Columbia Broadcasting System or NBC the National Broadcasting System. Q Ratings, the E Channel, O Magazine, America's media environment has been completely and thoroughly initialized. Now, there's an imaging war going on here in the American mindscape, and we don't think CPR should be left on that battlefield too encumbered by its heavy burden of nomenclature to be in the fight, just squirming and wheezing in the dust while its fundraising flatlines. Now, frankly, if it were me, we'd even dump the last two initials and just be known as C. But in taking the temperature around this building, that appears to be too radical, too soon. Some say... to hip-hop.
CPR's Ira Zipkin, fresh from a year-long fellowship at the Columbia School of Public Broadcasting, reported on the results of a poll CPR commissioned on the subject of its name. Some people may wonder why CPR thought it was worth spending increasingly scarce money on a poll about what to call itself. So, to be fair, we asked our poll respondents about that, too. Those numbers are still being recrunched. But on the main topic of the name, a full 40% of our sample gets much of our content online. So they thought the name radio in the CPR name was passé, or worse. 27% said they associated the word public in the context of broadcasting with reruns of John Tesh concerts. We're still analyzing whether that's a positive or a negative. But on the other hand, 72% of our folks associate the letters CPR with heart attacks. So what our polling told us in a nutshell is that we needed to do a lot more polling.
Justin Blassengame is CPR's in-house branding expert. He came up with the titles of our media review program, Media Nation, and our car Q&A broadcast, Auto Nation. He tackled the confusion over the meaning of the initials with energy and money.
Some people were arguing in our breakout sessions that the confusion with cardiopulmonary resuscitation was a deal breaker, a game ender, a beta blocker. To me, it was a branding challenge, right? So we came up with a campaign to run in important newspapers and centrist websites that didn't hide from the confusion but would meet it head on, right? The first treatment was CPR is not just for breathing anymore. We did, it doesn't expand your lungs, it expands your world. And then we also did some playful things with the letters themselves. So, for example, we pulled the C out of the logo and did a treatment around it that said, see what you're hearing. Then, of course, our focus group said, aha, well, okay, you're not for heart attacks, you're for deaf people. So back to the blank screen one more time.
The whole process took an entire fiscal quarter. At the end, the network reached a very surprising conclusion.
You know, when I delivered those opening remarks, I thought it was slam dunk to dump the name. But the more we drilled down, the more it looked like a wild three-pointer that bounced off the rim. We've got a legacy name. We've got equity in the legacy. And no matter what people associate when they hear that name, they don't assume an ambulance is coming. So we are proudly Continental Public Radio again, at least until we revisit the whole question next year.
So now that you know what to call us, don't forget to call us. And please give. I'm Aviva Schlorman.
And for now, that's all there is to see below the Beltway. We had help today from the Last Ditch Foundation. We give when others won't. Join us next time we take a peek behind the Capitol's curtains below the Beltway. I'm Milton Getzler. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Comes a rainstorm, put your rubbers on your feet. Comes a snowstorm, you can find a little heat. Comes love, nothing can be done. Comes a fire, you know just what to do. Blow a tire, you can buy another shoe. But comes love, nothing can be done. Don't try hiding, 'cause there isn't any use. You'll start sliding when your heart turns on the juice. Comes a headache, you can lose it in a day. Comes a toothache, see a dentist right away. Comes love, nothing can be done.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Some sorriness here for your listening pleasure. Police have apologized to a 14-year-old girl after accidentally shooting her with a taser. Officials in Nottingham. Ooh. You know, do you know the original name of Nottingham, ladies and gentlemen? Not kidding. Hand up raised now. Snottingham. Home of the snots. Look it up, please. Officials in Nottingham were aiming at a 20-year-old man as they tried to arrest him, but accidentally hit the girl who was standing nearby. That's right, he would have been the sheriff of Snottingham had they not changed the name. The incident was reported to the police watchdog, the Independent Police Complaints Commission, which passed it along to Nottinghamshire Police to investigate. A force spokesman said the incident happened about 10:35 p.m. last Wednesday. The 20-year-old man became aggressive to one of the officers who attempted to arrest him. He resisted arrest and assaulted the officer after a short struggle. The officer tried to restrain him by discharging his taser. The taser did not connect with the offender and struck a 14-year-old girl standing nearby. As soon as the officer realized, he canceled the discharge. That sounds painful. The teenage girl did not require hospital treatment, but the incident has been referred to the Complaints Commission. Officers have been liaising with the girl and her family and have apologized for what happened. And can we address that spokesperson for using the word liaising, please?
Sorry.
Dateline, Oregon. Multnomah County's top elected official has apologized for health inspectors who threatened to fine a 7-year-old for opening a lemonade stand at a local arts fair without a license. Quote, "A lemonade stand is a classic, iconic American kid thing to do," says County Chairman Jeff Cogan. "I don't want to be in the business of shutting that down." Cohen said he called Julie Murphy's mom to say he was sorry and that she appreciated the apology. Julie's mom said her daughter wanted to open a lemonade stand after seeing a cartoon character open one. Just be grateful your daughter's not watching The Simpsons. No, because, you know, characters do weird things on it. From MAC Cosmetics, we understand that product names in the MAC Rodart collection have offended some of our consumers and fans. This was never our intent, and we are very sorry. We're listening carefully to the comments posted and are grateful to those of you who've brought your concerns to the forefront of our attention. MAC will give a portion of the proceeds from the MAC Rodart collection to help those in need in Juarez. We are diligently investigating the best way to do this. The Rodart team says our makeup collaboration developed from inspirations on a road trip we took in Texas last year from El Paso to Marfa. The ethereal nature of this landscape influenced the creative development and desert palette of the collection. We're truly saddened about injustice in Juarez. The collaboration was attempted as a celebration of the beauty of the landscape and people in the areas. But they're not as sorry as the MAC people, apparently. The head of the Target Corporation is now taking the amazing step of apologizing for the company's financial support of Tom Emmer, the Republican nominee for governor in the company's home state of Minnesota, home of the Target Center, after coming under fire from gay rights activists. Target donated $150,000 to MN Forward, a business-backed group that is running ads for Emmer. The company was facing a backlash from some consumers and activists due to Emmer's support for a proposed constitutional amendment to back gay marriage. Now Target CEO Greg Steinhafel has written a letter to employees apologizing for the company's involvement. "While I firmly believe that a business climate conducive to growth is crucial to our future, I realize our decision affected many of you in a way I did not anticipate, and for that, I am genuinely sorry," wrote Steinhafel, adding, "The diversity of our team is an important aspect of our unique culture." That's the Target culture, ladies and gentlemen, in case you're wondering. Fox News host Greta Van Susteren apologized for a doozy of a mistake, her words, made on her show when a picture of Shirley Sherrod was used to illustrate a segment on Representative Maxine Waters. They are both African-American females. Waters, a California Democrat, has been charged by the House with ethics violation. Sherrod, as you know, was fired from the USDA for incorrectly being cast as a racist. What the two visually have in common is that they're both black women. Van Susteren took to her blog to issue an extremely effusive apology, calling the incident on her On the Record program, quote, "a very bad mistake and a painful one for which we are very apologetic. We really don't know what to say, and there is nothing you can post to make us feel better, not that we deserve to feel better. This mistake was bad, very bad, and we are immensely sorry." Van Susteren wrote. That's the kind of apology I liked. That's a fulsome apology, ladies and gentlemen. And because of what he now calls an error in judgment, a Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania carnival operator has been sparking an outcry by running at summer church carnivals and fire department fundraisers a shooting gallery game featuring a President Obama-like figure. I didn't think it was offensive, and you know, I made the wrong judgment on it, says Irvin L. Good. And that's all I can say about it. We did away with it. I'm apologizing to everybody in the world. I think. Not quite as good as Greta, but we'll accept it on behalf of everybody in the world. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to put the top on the kettle for this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world on your computer via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on your smartphone through Stitcher.com. Available as a free download for members at audible.com/theshow. Available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like 6 hours of electricity a day for the good people in Iraq if you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much. The tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of music heard here on, just part of the text-based splendor available to you at harryshearer.com. And don't forget, the show is on Twitter at LeTwits. Check us out there. And also check out TheBigUneasy.com for information on the upcoming nationwide screening of The Big Uneasy. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.